All right. Welcome back to World War Civ, episode 36. We are talking about the 1916 Easter Rising in Ireland. So I've got a couple of sources, courtesy of listeners and friends from Twitter, people from Ireland that we've had conversations with over the years. One is McVeigh and Ralston, Ireland, Colonialism and the Unfinished Revolution. But then that one is applying a theory of colonialism to the Ireland situation.
Okay.
It's kind of like high level. So 1916 is not a big narrative part of the book. It's just kind of assumes you know it in a way.
Okay.
So to get into the details, and there were details, there was Charles Townshend. That's basically the Penguin official history, Penguin Publishers, 1916 it's called. And then the Osprey, you have a lot of these, right, Dave? The Osprey book, where it's like a almost like a magazine, two columns of text, lots and lots of pictures and photos and even paintings, kind of cartoon-like paintings that show how the soldiers dressed. And
very concentrated on the military aspects, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Uniforms and equipment and so on. Yeah.
So that, for this kind of episode, I thought that those were the right sources. And there is, for readers, I mean, yeah, if you're a reader who's listening, these are really, really detailed. So if you really want to get into every detail, because it's like the whole thing took a week, right? I mean, so this is not day by day. This is hour by hour levels of detail on what is happening on both sides, what every commander said, etc. So it's pretty impressive. It's
a particularly Irish thing, but yeah, virtually everything about this is known.
Yeah, that's right. There are some, every once in a while they say no one knows why this happened, but for the most part it's everyone knows why this happened. here's what happened. So
yeah, I'm relying on Constantine Fitzgibbon, who wrote a piece about it in 1969, AJP Taylor, of course. And I also found that I had in my possession a book called The Insurrection in Dublin by James Stevens. It was written in 1916, so immediately after. And it's a highly personal memoir by someone who was not involved, but observed from outside. So that's
was he in Dublin?
He was in Dublin.
Okay.
Yeah. So the we're going to start with a spoiler. Justa will appreciate this. Here's a description of the whole thing in a nutshell. If you only want to listen to the first minute of the podcast, here it is. The Easter Rising was a complete failure. Yet without it, Ireland might never have been free of English rule. So essentially, the Easter Rising was another failed uprising by the Irish, and not just a glorious failure, but somehow in a roundabout way an indirect complete success.
Mm-hmm. Military failure, political success. I mean, it wasn't it's not a military failure if there's no chance to win a conquest and you didn't win a conquest. I mean, so right. It's hard to even rate it militarily alone. You can't separate the two. I have been thinking about, and I don't think it's a perfect or even a very good analogy, but my mind couldn't help going there and thinking, like, was this Easter Rising has some kind of, I was comparing the Easter Rising of 1916 to the October 7th raid in Gaza. You know,
yes.
It was this, because there are elements, like they make an attack and then they fall back and they're assuming that there's going to be a counterattack. The counterattack is more brutal than they expected. So there's certainly some similarities.
Yeah, for sure. I saw it immediately as well. So Fitzgibbon starts off by explaining that the English simply didn't understand the Irish. There's an interesting degree of ignorance, considering how close the islands are. But the mass of English didn't know much about Ireland and certainly didn't understand its people. But the upper classes, too, they were, he says, bewildered by the fact that most Irish and all of the educated Irish spoke English and wrote it, too. He says, often better than most Englishmen. And the English were also confused by the fact that most of the Irish governing class were of English or at least Norman ancestry. And they still hadn't figured out that for the last two centuries, it was these people who were leading the fight for Irish independence. You know, you mentioned names like Grattan or Wolfe Tone or Parnell. You know, these are basically Anglo-Irish leaders. And the reason that they were fighting for independence is because the English had destroyed their government and stolen their lands.
Was Wolfe Tone Protestant too?
I think he was, yeah. There's no shortage of Protestants involved in the yeah. Irish independence movement.
Amazing.
Yeah. And the English also never seemed to figure out that the Irish way of life was essentially different from theirs. Fitzgibbon says, you know, sure, he's he's perhaps prejudiced, but he says less brutal, less materialistic, more spiritual, with infinitely less snobbery and class distinction. So he gives a very brief history of 1,000 years. Ireland had been conquered several times by the Norse, by the Normans, and then by the English. But if the conquerors remained in Ireland, they often changed. He says, and I quote, seduced by the ease and pleasure of an Irish attitude that looks for charm, gaiety, and wit rather than for profit. And then these conquerors became more Irish than the Irish. The English dismissed this as fecklessness. Interesting word. It means lacking in initiative and irresponsible. They made the stereotypic Irishman a figure of fun, a comedic character, and called him Paddy, short for Patrick. The English remembered that they had crushed every Irish rebellion, but forgot that thousands of Irishmen had fought in the armies of Europe and the British Army with great distinction. So they made fun of, you know, this lazy, irresponsible Paddy, forgetting that they were capable of, you know, great feats on the battlefield, which, you know, you would think the English would respect.
And this includes, by the way, participation in the British Empire.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
As in India, Africa, etc., as we will see, some of these veterans that are on the rebel side were veterans of these imperial campaigns, too.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the English were annoyed by how troublesome the Irish were, especially considering how decently the English had treated them, at least in the English view. Yeah, it was true that English liberals had let Ireland starve in the 1840s in adherence to their laissez-faire economic theories. But they knew better now, and they regretted that past. You know, sorry about that. Home rule, it'll eventually be organized, and the Irish will get some kind of partial sovereignty. But, you know, with the Great War, that would have to be postponed until Germany was defeated. You know, surely Paddy wouldn't mind. Paddy would join the British Army, as he and thousands of other Irishmen always had. The Ulster Volunteers, if you remember our episode on the Ulster Crisis, these are the Northern Ireland Protestants, who had been planning a rebellion with German assistance. Well, those volunteers were taken on as official units and incorporated in the British Army. The Irish volunteers were ignored. Now, in the British Army, you could have a symbol on your uniform. For example, Canadian troops had British uniforms with a maple leaf for Canada. The Northern Irish units had the Red Hand of Ulster as an official military symbol. The Irish harp was not used. The Irish Nationalist Party, led by John Redmond, accepted the postponement of home rule. And by doing this, he's including the Irish volunteers, some 200,000 men, only a few thousand of whom were armed and trained. This force had been created during the Ulster crisis as a counter to the Ulster volunteers. So both groups were prepared to set aside their quarrel temporarily. And tens of thousands from both sides volunteered for the British Army and went off to die in Flanders. But there were some Republicans not prepared to do that. So you made the point that some of these guys had military experience.
So there's a couple of both the Penguin and the Osprey books make this point that there's Dublin's bookstores at this time had many copies of the British Infantry Training Manual of 1911, and so this became the Bible of the rebels. They got all these copies and they organized themselves on the same lines as the British, so the same kind of battle order, command structure as
interesting
the British Infantry Training Manual. I mean, maybe one is citing the other, but I think they both decided that it was important enough to say.
Yeah, well, and with these guys serving in the British Army, they're very aware of how the British will respond to a particular situation. So Ireland looked pretty peaceful in 1914. Redmond even suggested that the British didn't need to leave any troops in Ireland, that the volunteers were quite capable of keeping order. But as I said, there were a few who weren't inclined to wait. They also weren't prepared to accept the limited sovereignty that Britain might be inclined to grant them at a later date. So again, the issue is, you know, being a dominion like Canada or Australia and recognizing the English or the British king as, you know, their king. And partial sovereignty just wasn't acceptable. And these people were the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood. I hasten to say this is not the IRA. This is a precursor. So as the name suggests, Republican, they wanted complete independence, separate from the British Crown. The IRB started in 1858 as a secret society. And surprisingly, they never had more than about 2,000 members, some of whom lived in England or in the United States. The majority could, I guess you could describe them as intellectuals. This and their secrecy and their determination made them resemble Lenin's little Bolshevik party. Major difference, though, was that the IRB's aims were political rather than economic. And these guys ended up providing the general staff of the Movement for Independence. And from 1910 on, they had a journal. They published a journal entitled Irish Freedom. So their reaction to the war was very different. As early as August 1914, the IRB decided that there had to be an insurrection while Britain was at war. So they had some brains and they had considerable sums of money, mostly from Irish Americans, but not much else. They would have to act through Irish patriotic organizations, some of which they partially controlled, but they would need weapons rather desperately. Apart from the north, apart from Ulster, and maybe a handful of rich landlords in the south, the people of Ireland wanted freedom from British rule. But most were prepared to accept the home rule solution, even if they had to wait. So the IRB could rely on quite a bit of emotional sympathy, but very little practical support. The Catholic Church would oppose an uprising, and the parish priests were very powerful, very influential spokesmen. So if they are planning an uprising, it's not going to be a general revolt that spreads all over Ireland. It's going to be small, and they knew that from the beginning. Redmond and the Irish Nationalists had a huge number of volunteers, but they were mostly unarmed. And as I said, tens of thousands had joined the British Army. So only a few could be relied on to support the IRB. One was Owen McNeill, a historian. He was chief of staff of the volunteers. And one of the commandants was Patrick Pierce, a former schoolmaster. Both were members of the IRB, and although they disagreed over tactics. And this is, as you said, Justin, the what's known about their personalities and what they said, the conversations were endless. These guys talked, and somebody recorded virtually everything that was said and then included it in their history of the rising.
So maybe McNeill, right? Because McNeill wrote a lot.
Oh, God. After, too. Yeah, yeah. There was, though, another small paramilitary force. In 1908, James Larkin had created the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, and they went on strike in 1913. The strike was broken up by strong-arm methods, as, you know, most strikes were at the time. But this influenced James Connolly, who had founded the Socialist Republican Party in 1896. He decided that the workers needed a defensive organization. So he created the Irish Citizen Army. It was very small, but very efficient.
Yeah, the left, we love James Connolly. So okay. We're always reading James, we're always sharing James Connolly quotes on Twitter and reading James Connolly letters. He didn't write all that much. He was definitely a man of action, but he wrote dispatches for newspapers and things like that. There are collections of his writings. And he in the there's an interesting how he came to join the uprising of 1916 is described in the Osprey book, and it's quite a little story in itself. It says the leader of the Workers, Irish Transport and General Workers Union, and de facto head of the Citizen Army, had declared for some time that his men would take up arms against the British regime in Dublin, irrespective of the volunteers' intentions. And so, fearful that Connolly would compromise their plans, they arranged for him to be kidnapped and taken to a safe house where, for the next few days, intense negotiations went on between the captive and his captors. In the end, Connolly was convinced by their arguments and was admitted to the council, pledging the support of the Citizen Army to the proposed insurrection. And when he brought this small but efficient organization to the volunteers, Osprey notes that with the addition of James Connolly to their ranks, the drilling and practice and training was supplemented with courses on such diverse subjects as street fighting, urban fortifications, and the manufacture of explosives.
Oh.
So this was can you imagine being James Connolly's family? Like, he just doesn't come home for a few days, and then he shows up, and it's like, where were you, James? And he's just like, oh, nowhere. <You know>? Nothing, you know, don't worry about it.
I wonder what the British thought about that.
Yeah, I don't, who knows if
they certainly knew they who he watching. Was.
They knew who he was, but yeah, I mean, contrasting this with, I read, you remember Thomas Pakenham, I think was his first
name? Yes.
Pakenham. Yeah. So Pakenham, when we did the Scramble for Africa series, I would always go to Pakenham and see what he had to say, because he wrote essentially the only big book on the Scramble for Africa that we found, and does not share our point of view on the Scramble for Africa, but, you know, the chronology is the chronology. But he also wrote a similarly toned book about the uprising of 1798 in Ireland, the year of liberty. Was it 1798 or 96, Dave? I think it was 98. I think they tried to do something in 96 too, but 1798.
Yeah, the year of the French.
So 1798, the thoroughness with which the British had infiltrated the Irish was devastating, and they had so many moles in the organization, and it doesn't seem to have been the case. They had some intelligence assets for sure, but the Irish seem to have adapted to that and were less transparent to the British, I'd say, than they.
The IRB certainly, yeah. The Irish nationalists were still pretty thoroughly riddled with informers, but the IRB was a little tighter organization. There was another prominent supporter of the movement, and she came from the women's organization. This was Countess Markievicz. Her real name was Constance Gore Booth. Her father was an Anglo-Irish landlord and Arctic explorer. During the famine of 1879-1880, Sir Henry Gore Booth provided free food to the tenants on his estate, and his daughters developed a deep sympathy for the poor tenants and the workers. Now, Constance ended up marrying a Polish artist, hence the Countess Markievicz, her title and married name, but she remained an Irish nationalist, a suffragist, and a socialist. The IRB also could rely on a group of boys. These were the Fianna boys, F-I-A-N-N-A, later to become the name of a Irish political party, the Fianna Fáil. So Fianna was a Gaelic word for the small bands of hunters and warriors in the early Middle Ages. So these were young men who had not inherited property, so they spent much of their time in the wild hunting and raiding. And the Irish nationalists in the 1800s, the Fenians, took their name from this too. So the Fianna boys were like Boy Scouts. They had physical training, but they also learned Irish language, Gaelic, and history. So she founded this group, Countess Markievicz founded this group in 1909. And apparently she acted as a sort of a, you know, mother to many of them, nursed them when they were sick, and taught them to shoot. Okay, so maybe not entirely like a mother, but unless your mother taught you to shoot. The IRB had come to an important conclusion. So after all the experiences of trying to win independence by political means through the English Parliament, they basically adopted an attitude or a strategy which they expressed as Sinn Féin. So S-I-N-N-F-E-I-N, pronounced Sinn Féin. The best translation is ourselves alone. It definitely means independence from British rule, but it's also a reference to Ireland's history as they tried to get help from Spain and then France and now Germany, only to be let down every time.
Yeah, the letdown in 1798 was dramatic. Pakenham's book, The Year of Liberty, it's farcical what the French did. The Irish were fighting for months, and then the French showed up after it was all over and made some kind of stand, and then they surrendered and were allowed to return to France, basically.
Yeah.
So it was really different status.
Was the Directory. I wonder if Napoleon had been in charge, if things might have been different. He probably wouldn't have sent any troops.
Yeah, I mean, there were meetings. I guess Pakenham describes meetings between Wolfe Tone and Napoleon. Napoleon must have had some position in the military hierarchy by 1798. No.
Well, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think it was at a meeting with Napoleon that this was decided. And well, I mean, you know how Pakenham is. He describes walking Wolfe Tone's cab ride, and then Wolfe Tone coming and meeting Napoleon, and what Napoleon looked like, and how he picked up the piece of paper and handed it to him, and so on. So it was Napoleon was definitely a big character in this drama, but maybe not the supreme commander.
Yeah. So Sinn Féin means independence, but it also means that the Irish have to rely on themselves alone. So a change in strategy for sure. To the British, the Shinners, as they called them, represented violent republicanism. But in fact, Sinn Féin was a democratic political party founded by Arthur Griffith, a writer and newspaper editor, in 1905. They ran a candidate in the 1908 election, but he was defeated. As time went on, though, the Sinn Féin won over many of the more extreme members of Redmond's Nationalist Party. Griffith, who was the editor of a journal called United Irishmen, believed in constitutional tactics. But unlike Parnell and Redmond, he no longer trusted the British Liberal Party, right? We've tried to work through with the Liberals, and twice now they've let us down. So ourselves alone was a pretty powerful idea. It had a lot of traction. If the IRB had very few resources, there was no shortage of opposition. First off, you had the Royal Irish Constabulary. These were armed police, 10,000 strong, who lived in barracks. Now, these are Irishmen, but loyal to Britain. Well-trained, well-equipped, and Fitzgibbon says, only moderately unpopular. The English headquarters were in Dublin Castle. So when you were referring to the English headquarters or the English government, you just said the castle. There were the Dublin police. Like English police, they weren't armed, but weapons were available if they needed them. And there were 1,000 of them, including a special branch who monitored and infiltrated the Irish nationalist and Republican organizations. There were a lot of them. They just weren't particularly good at it, though. I guess, the nationalists and certainly the Republicans were just good at figuring out who was genuine and who was a fake. I don't know if they followed them or watched them go home or watched them go to the castle to report. And of course, there was also the British Army.
Oh, yeah. So here are some of the players in the British Army or who come to be involved in this battle of 1916. There's Lieutenant General Sir John Grenfell Maxwell. I'm glad I got through all of that. Veteran of Egypt, Tel El Kebir battle in Egypt, Sudan. The Sudan campaign and the Boer War in South Africa. He's recommended by Kitchener, also notorious for Sudan campaign. And we've been talking about Kitchener's role in World War One, mm-hmm. many episodes now. And Kitchener recommended him specifically because he lacked any experience in Ireland. So some fresh eyes on the Irish problem. Brigadier Lowe, also a veteran of Egypt and the Boer War. And then there's Colonel Ernest William Stuart King McConchy, M-A-C-O-N-C-H-Y. And he's a veteran of what's called the Hazara Expedition of 1888. So this is Pakistan, Afghanistan, present day, British India back then. And the Osprey book says that at a place called Ghazikot, he held off a surprise attack by several hundred native warriors. So campaigning in the 19th century in what's today Northwest Frontier Province, I think it's got a different name now, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Waziristan. So veterans of many imperial wars are converging.
And all chosen because they knew nothing about Ireland. So yes. That way they haven't been infected or seduced by this, lackadaisical Irish attitude. Isn't that strange that you would pick your guys specifically because they know nothing about the place? Oh, boy. Yeah, the British leaders in Ireland were not the best or the brightest. Asquith and his Liberal government was fixated on the war, and Ireland was expected to be quiet. So your best guys you're going to have in your war cabinet or in one of these committees – or the munitions ministry or stuff like that. So what was left over for Ireland wasn't sparkling. The chief secretary was Augustin Birrell, a charming writer who seems to have considered his job as head of the administration as something of a sideline. His main preoccupation was being in London and being charming. So he was networking and letting himself be seen. His assistant, Sir Matthew Nathan, was another guy who knew very little about the Irish and was happiest at his desk dealing with routine paperwork. And the officer in command of the British Army in Ireland was Major General Field, another guy who had no idea at all of what was going on in Ireland. And the Lord Lieutenant, this is basically the Governor General, the top representative of the King, was Lord Wimborne. He knew Ireland well, and he was worried because he had the feeling something was up. In terms of weapons, it was pretty much a David and Goliath situation. During the Ulster crisis, the Ulster volunteers brought in 35,000 German rifles. The Irish volunteers managed to get their hands on 1,000. So this is this is where we have to start. They just had to get more weapons. So Sir Roger Casement went to Germany. Do you remember Casement?
He's the star of Adam
in the Scramble.
Yeah, we talked about him in the Scramble. He's also one of the stars of the probably, if people know about Casement, they know about him from Adam Hochschild's book, King Leopold's Ghost, because there's, what's the guy that, there was another guy, a really important guy too, who wrote Blood, something about the blood of another British guy. Anyway, I'll find it. I'll look it up. But Casement was another one of the major characters of that book. So yeah. And Casement, incidentally, or not, Anglo-Irish Protestant.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he worked for Henry Morton Stanley in the Congo and then became a diplomat in the British colonial service. And then he blew the whistle. The Casement Report of 1904 was a comprehensive investigation of human rights abuses in King Leopold's Congo and created a sensation. And then Casement went on to report on abuses in the rubber industry in Peru and received a knighthood for this in 1911. I didn't go into the stories here, but if you looked up the rubber or Casement in Peru, unbelievable stories of how the workers were abused, basically locked in huts as prisoners, forced labor.
Rubber is the book I was thinking of, and the author's E.D. Morrell. So E.D. Morrell is the other major character in the.
Yeah, and he was Belgian?
British journalist. Originally it says Edmund Dean Morrell, originally Georges Edouard Pierre Achille Morrell de Ville. Doesn't sound like a super British name to English name to me. But yeah, he was some kind of clerk.
Yes.
He was some kind of shipping clerk.
Yes.
And he was watching all kinds of things come and leave empty.
Yes.
And
he just realized that the imports from the Congo vastly outnumbered the exports to the Congo. It's like we're taking all this stuff out and putting nothing back in.
Yeah.
So Casement's experiences in Africa and in the Boer War turned him into an anti-imperialist. And once he retired from the consular service, he became involved in the Irish Republican movement. So he went to Germany, where he tried to get German help, primarily weapons for the IRB. And he also tried to persuade Irish prisoners of war in German hands to join an Irish legion. Like basically the Germans will free you if you come and fight for Ireland. And he had very little success.
Apparently 50 people signed up. So okay. It's interesting because this, I didn't know this, but this is a prequel or predecessor to the Indian National Army, which when we get to World War II, you can be certain you will be hearing a lot about. The Indian National Army led by Subhash Chandra Bose. And it was organized, it was com- composed of Indian prisoners of war who were captured by the Japanese during World War II. And the Japanese appointed an agent to help Bose get this organized. And of course, Bose was killed. It was apparently some kind of accident, or maybe it wasn't an accident. I don't remember, but Bose was killed. And the Indian National Army was not super successful militarily, but the whole story of the Indian National Army and the trial of some of their leaders for treason, and it led to all, it was one of those things that played a major role in India ultimately getting independence when they did.
Yeah. Actually, so, they tried this in World War One. You remember the British disaster at Kut in Mesopotamia. Many Indian soldiers were captured by the Turks and horribly treated. But then on second thought, the Germans and the Turks offered, you know, to let them fight for the Turks. I don't remember them being very numerous, but yeah. So Casement failed pretty badly, and all he got was some weapons. Actually, quite a few weapons. Unfortunately, the British had broken German naval codes very early in the war. In fact, the real story is the Russians had recovered the body of a German naval officer who drowned in the Baltic, and he had the naval codes on his body. So the Russians shared this information with the British. So the British could listen in on German wireless messages. And that means that they knew that a German ship carrying weapons was headed for Ireland. They knew in advance.
The ship was called the Norwegian flagged steamer, the Aud, A-U-D. It sailed from the German port of Lübeck on April 9th, 1916. It was not a Norwegian steamer. It was a German vessel called the Liebau, and it carried 20,000 captured Russian rifles, 10 machine guns, and 1 million rounds of ammunition plus explosives. So, yeah, they were.
That's quite a bit.
They had quite a haul. Yeah.
Casement went back first. He was not aboard that ship. He went to he returned to Ireland on a U-boat. Yeah. And when he landed, he was arrested because the British were waiting for him.
You want to talk about details, Dave? He was sick. There were three of them. Casement was sick. The other two went on, but they had to leave him behind. He's a big man, apparently, and he was sick, so they couldn't take him. And so he was sitting in some, you know, shack or shelter that they had, and that's when the British came and got him. So.
And what happened to the ship?
Yes. So they arrested him, and they knew something. They knew from the code breaking that there was a ship somewhere. And so once they captured him, they knew that the ship was going to be somewhere. So they started trying to eliminate using process of elimination. And they had a lot of their Navy around. So they started to look for which ship it was. They figured out that it was the Aud, and then they started chasing the Aud. Then as they closed in, the Germans aboard the ship scuttled it. They abandoned the ship. They scuttled it. They blew up the bottom out of it and sent it to the bottom of the sea. So no 20,000 rifles, no 10 machine guns, and no 1 million rounds of ammunition. Instead, it was just a couple of other missions, one by Erskine Childers, another African veteran, Scramble for Africa imperialist veteran, and someone named Connor O'Brien. And they had some much smaller ships much earlier, like from 1914. So they had they had like 900 guns or 1,000 guns or something. And those guns were single shot Mausers, obsolete weapons basically, but with big recoil. Very problematic arms situation by the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there's one other thing. There's a quote from one of these leaders. It might be McNeil. I don't think it was McNeil. I think it was Pierce or someone like that. And they said they were arming themselves, I think you mentioned this, to try to match the Ulster volunteers. and they, one of them said something like, there's nothing more comical than a than seeing a nationalist without a rifle across from an Ulsterman who has one, kind of thing.
So. Okay. Well, the British put Casement on trial for high treason. Now, ironically, when he was arrested, he was going to warn his associates in the IRB not to launch a rising. But they put him on trial for high treason. AJP Taylor notes another irony in the fact that the prosecutor was F.E. Smith, later the first Earl of Birkenhead. 2 years earlier, Smith had been a leading advocate of high treason in the Ulster crisis. 2 years earlier, Smith was saying, we'll disobey the government and we'll fight, you know, and now he's prosecuting someone who's fighting the government. So Casement was found guilty and he was sentenced to death. There was considerable sympathy for him, though, mostly because of his work in the Congo and Peru. There were several people who spoke up for him. And some thought that the penalty was too harsh. So in order to justify the death penalty, the British government leaked some excerpts from his private journals exposing him as a homosexual. And support for Casement, for a reprieve for him, declined dramatically. Some still stood by him. Arthur Conan Doyle, W.B. Yeats, and George Bernard Shaw still supported Casement, but Joseph Conrad changed his mind. Casement was hanged on the 3rd of August, 1916. Now, with the failure to get any guns, Owen McNeill called off the uprising.
So speaking of the many conversations between McNeill and Pierce, apparently he got wind of it and he demanded to talk to Pierce, and he went to Pierce and he said, I heard that you called for an insurrection, and Pierce didn't deny it. And then McNeill said, I'll not be responsible for the calling out of a half-armed force. And then okay. They went back to him, and so there's a lot of back and forth, and they thought they had convinced him. I'll say that in a minute. You go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So the idea of an uprising is going to have to be postponed. And given how thoroughly Dublin Castle had infiltrated the volunteers, Lord Wimborne knew that the rising had been cancelled. But he also knew that one had been planned, and it was supposed to take place after Casement's guns were landed. So on April 23rd, he demanded that Major General Nathan arrest between 60 and 100 Irish leaders. He supplied the names. And Nathan basically persuaded the Lord Lieutenant that no action was necessary. Without guns, there's not going to be any trouble. Burrell, of course, who's supposed to be in charge, was in London, so he's not even there. What Wimborne and Nathan didn't know was that Owen McNeill's decision had finally split the volunteers. The IRB was almost solidly behind Patrick Pierce, and Connolly's Citizen Army was also prepared to go ahead, even though the attempt looked to be near suicidal. Sinn Féin, ourselves alone. So this is a simplification. we both, when reading about this, were astounded by the level of detail that you can get about the planning and the preparation for it. There were major personality clashes, multiple disagreements, considerable bitterness, and endless conversations between leaders trying to convince each other, you know, to go or to not go. But McNeill's decision to call off the rising and Pierce's decision to go ahead effectively destroyed the volunteers and the Nationalist Party that they were supposed to be fighting for.
Yeah. So, like I said, that Pierce thought they had managed to get McNeill back on board on Good Friday, because McNeill said, if it's a choice of fighting or being suppressed, then I shall fight. But then on Sunday in the in the Irish newspaper, the Sunday Independent, on Easter Sunday, there was a specific countermand of the order published. So they said, you know, whatever you've heard about exercises, etc., they're not happening. So the Pierce and Connolly and them, they met and they said, we're going to go on Monday then.
That's so funny that you would use the newspaper to announce, you know, the revolution is postponed.
Well, they didn't, you know, not in exactly those words, but in almost exactly those words.
Yeah. And then boys on bicycles raced around the country carrying the news that the Rising was canceled. So between the newspaper and the boys all over the place, Major General Nathan must have felt that he was right. Nothing's going to happen. On Easter Monday, many of the British officers went to the horse races. Now, the IRB weren't fooling themselves. They knew that this was really not going to succeed. They knew it was suicidal. Patrick Pearse wrote to his mother before the Rising, "The day is coming when I shall be shot, swept away, and my colleagues like me." And his mother wrote back asking about her other son, Patrick's brother, William Pearse. And Pearse wrote back, "Willie, shot like the others, we'll all be shot." James Connolly supposedly said that the odds against them were 1,000 to 1. And on the morning of the Rising, one of his men asked if there was any hope. And Connolly cheerfully replied, "None whatever." So that part I have to admit, I don't understand what they expected to achieve.
I didn't see that. I didn't see that in the Osprey book or the other one or the Penguin book. We can talk about their plan. Oh, yeah, you're going
to
talk about
what they plan. Yeah, so the idea was to occupy several key points in the city and hold them for as long as possible. So they had three very faint hopes. The country might rise in sympathy. The British might realize that they couldn't hold Ireland and they might withdraw their troops, right? If the Irish are going to continue these desperate uprisings, like after a while, maybe you'd realize you can't hold on to this forever. Or maybe the Germans would intervene. The Irish had no artillery at all, and they could hold out only if the British didn't use their artillery, which was a possibility. Why would the British want to destroy downtown Dublin? It was largely British-owned property. So, you know, maybe they wouldn't use their artillery. So Easter Monday was a holiday, and there were crowds of people in the streets who saw the volunteers and the citizen army march down the streets through the city to seize their various strong points.
Can I just interject? Because the just a little bit more about the geopolitics of the plan. They were various hopes that if Germany started to win the war, Britain would have to put more troops in France. So there's different analyses that the Irish are doing there where they say, well, if there's a breakthrough on the front. We talked about Somme and Verdun. So they're watching these battles as they're going, and they're figuring if things go well for Germany on the battlefield, Britain won't be able to do as much here. They're also, in the Osprey book, they say, it would appear the whole of the IRB Supreme Council, many if not all of the recent formed national volunteers would join the Rising, giving the volunteers a significant numerical edge over the British forces in Ireland. An additional consideration was the struggle for Verdun, which had been raging since February. A significant breakthrough by the German army would critically alter the position on the Western Front, this threat being in itself the catalyst for the impending British Somme offensive of July 1916. So there are these. So the question must be asked, or could indeed, would Britain have sent a major force to Ireland to put down a rebellion while ignoring French cries for support and assistance? So these are the things that are going into their calculation.
Still a pretty big gamble.
Yeah, a huge gamble.
Yeah. So Patrick Pearse and James Connolly took over the General Post Office and made it the headquarters of the uprising. Eamon Daly captured the forecourts where lawyers were trained. Michael Mallon and Countess Markievicz occupied St. Stephen's Green. And Eamon de Valera took over Boland's Flour Mill, which was on the route that British reinforcements would come into the city. So in total, the rebels occupied five major points north of the River Liffey and nine south of it. An attempt to take Dublin Castle failed. They also tried to take weapons from the British arsenal in Phoenix Park, but only got away with a few rifles. They did successfully cut the telephone lines to Dublin Castle and repulsed a cavalry charge by Lancers down Sackville Street. That's now O'Connell Street. It was renamed, and that's where the GPO, the General Post Office, was and still is. I saw it a couple times in the 1980s, and there were still bullet holes in the front of it. They kept it that way. I'm not sure if they fixed them since, but I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't. The British were taken by surprise. So the castle immediately ordered troops from the
Curragh. Sorry. Let me jump in again.
Okay.
The Townshend, the Penguin book, this is one of these lots of detail and a lot. These are where there are some mysteries, at least identified by Townshend, because there were apparently better choices that they could have made. So there's a lot of, I don't know why they took this spot instead of that one. The castle was not as well defended as they had expected. So if they had made a more serious attempt, they would have gotten it.
Right.
That's what Townsend thinks. He says there was hardly anybody there, but they got a little bit of opposition and then they just abandoned the idea of trying to take it. There was some hotel. There's several high points overlooking. They took a place that was too far back from the street to have any control of the street. There's a lot of these kinds of decisions that Townsend questions. And I don't know.
Does he mention Trinity College?
Yeah.
So the original idea was to take Trinity College because the way it's built, it's a natural fortress, mm-hmm. but they didn't target it because they didn't have enough men to hold it.
Right.
So
yeah, because of the countermand, there's a lot in Townsend's book, McNeil ordering people not to come out.
Right.
Monday morning was just, I mean, a lot of the recruiters walking around and wrangling people, and then people going into units that were not their own because some of the people who showed up were just, they just had to go into whatever unit was available. So there was just a lot of, the countermand had a very negative effect.
Yeah.
In terms of them, their ability to get themselves organized, lots of people just didn't show up. Like lots of commanding officers didn't show up because of the countermand. So it was a big mess on the morning of, and they were late, and then they made some choices about what to take and what not to take. It's unclear though, right? I mean, we have to say, even if they had done every single thing right, they may not have won, but certainly they made decisions that later military historians questioned.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, then it was a typical Irish uprising with, you know, great ideas, and the execution was a little off. So the British immediately sent to the military base for troops and appealed to London for reinforcements. And in London, the commander-in-chief there was Sir John French, the former commander of the British Expeditionary Force in France. He was Irish and an ardent unionist. So he immediately ordered four divisions transferred to Ireland. So given the situation in France, his conclusion was that Ireland is more important, or we need troops there. And the British reaction was, you know, quite clear from the very first moment. The rebels were going to be crushed. Tuesday was relatively calm. The British approached cautiously. They moved troops and artillery into Trinity College. Martial law was declared. And one British officer, Captain Bowen Colthurst, had three journalists shot. They were shot while trying to escape. I know you've heard that before, and sure, you're going to hear it again.
Yeah, I mean, this is also told in great detail in Townsend. He took them from one place to another. They were completely surrounded by high walls. They were absolutely not going to escape anywhere. And one of the journalists was fairly famous, Sheehy Skeffington, and they were just executed in cold blood. So Bowen Colthurst, he got in big trouble for this murder of three people, and so much so that he retired to Canada on a military pension and died decades later. So, you know, justice
was he charged?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think he was charged and convicted, but then there was some kind of insanity defense or something.
Yeah, because I saw a reference to him as mad. Sure. So, oh, well, he's insane, so that's okay.
Yeah, so that's okay.
By Wednesday, the rebels were outnumbered 20-1. The British destroyed Liberty Hall, headquarters of the Labour Party and the trade unions, by shelling them from a gunboat on the river. even though the rebels had anticipated this and the building was empty. And of course, British gunfire wasn't very accurate. They hit other buildings and killed quite a few civilians. In one case, they used a 9-pounder gun against a single sniper. Yeah. So the answer to the IRB's guess that, you know, maybe they won't use artillery. Well, yes, they will. Rather indiscriminately, too. The city began to burn and civilians began to starve because no food was coming into the city. It's hard for people of our era to remember this or to realize this, but there were no fridges, refrigerators or freezers back then. If you wanted food, you went to the market and bought it for the day. You didn't buy a bunch of food and take it home and store it, because you had no means of storing it. So this wasn't a police action. It was actually full-scale war. And several accounts emphasize the point that there was no attempt to spare civilians. If they were in the line of fire, too bad for them. British reinforcements were coming up from the port of Kingstown, which has been renamed. It's now Dunleary. And they were ambushed by De Valera's men in Boland's flour mill. The British suffered heavy casualties, but they got through by sheer weight of numbers. St. Stephen's Green was retaken. Daly and Countess Markievicz retreated into the Royal College of Surgeons. On Thursday, a new British commander arrived, and this is your guy Maxwell, recently returned from Egypt. So under martial law, he now has almost unlimited powers. It's not the civil authorities anymore. It's the army. And as you said, he had zero understanding of Irish politics, zero understanding of the mood of the country. The prime minister had told him to put down the rebellion with all possible speed. And that's what he did, regardless of any other consequences. So the British reinforcements came into action. These were largely untrained men. And when they discovered that many of the rebels were not in uniform, and, you know, I would ask, how could they be? So when they discovered that the guys that they were fighting were not in uniform, the soldiers began shooting male civilians on sight. The post office was shelled. It started to burn from the top down. Connolly was wounded twice. The first wound he hid from his men, but the second was a little more obvious. His foot was shattered.
Dublin Connolly was also apparently a very large man, so not easy to deal with the fact that he can't just carry him around. He's being carried around by like three of his men.
Yeah. So Dublin was on fire. The streets were full of, you know, small arms fire, and water was often cut off. So there was no way to do anything about the fire. On Friday, Connolly ordered the female fighters in the post office to leave. And later in the day, he and Pierce and the rest of the men escaped from the burning building. The British continued to shell it, not realizing that the defenders were gone. And a last battle was fought for King Street near the forecourts. It took 5,000 British soldiers with artillery and armored cars 28 hours to advance about 150 yards against 200 rebels armed with rifles. And this battle was when soldiers of the South Staffordshire Regiment found some civilians hiding in cellars and bayoneted and shot them. On Saturday morning, Connolly and Pierce surrendered unconditionally, and it was the rising was officially over. It's hard to estimate the casualties. About 500 British casualties and probably twice as many Irish, including civilians. Large parts of Dublin were in ruins, and repairs cost about £2.5 million. Taylor's book has a photo of the burned out shell of the post office with ruined buildings beside it. And the caption for the photo is "British rule triumphs in Ireland."
I think I'm looking at that photo right now.
Yeah. Yeah. On Sunday, the rebel prisoners were marched from one prison compound to another. And it's interesting, they were jeered at and booed by the crowds that gathered to watch, especially in the slum areas. So just a reminder that they had not been supported by most people before the rising and still weren't afterwards. So on direct orders of the cabinet in London, reprisals were to be swift, direct, and brutal. The leaders were tried by court-martial and shot. And only after the shootings had been carried out were their deaths announced. William Pierce was shot. He was no leader. He was just a rank-and-file guy. But they shot him because he was Patrick's brother. Patrick Pierce was shot. Countess Markievicz was sentenced to death, but then her sentence was commuted to prison. Joseph Plunkett was seriously ill. He was an invalid, and they shot him anyway. Only one of the leaders was not shot, Eamon de Valera, because his mother was American, and the British didn't want to offend the United States, not at this point of the war, right? You're trying to persuade them to come in on your side, so they decided not to shoot the American. So de Valera survived. But the most heinous crime, at least to the Irish way of thinking, was the shooting of Connolly. He was dying. They had to prop him up in bed for his court-martial. And he couldn't stand, so they tied him to a chair so that they could shoot him. And it was this that caused a wave of disgust to cross over all of Ireland. Asquith defended the measures in Parliament. But when he finally realized how much damage they had done, he sacked Maxwell. And now the British finally realized that their reprisals, their methods, had done more to unite the Irish than the Irish National Party or the IRB had ever achieved. So they changed their policy. There had been about 3,000 men arrested after the rising, and they were released. And many of the survivors immediately went to work creating a newer and more powerful organization. This was the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. Lloyd George had an idea. He called an Irish convention to solve the Irish problem. Interesting terminology,
like,
right?
Like a white paper, like one of Trudeau's white papers to solve the native problem.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the way these executions have played out remind me of a little bit of the Louis Riel rebellion or resistance and McDonald's decision, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He'll hang though every dog bark in Quebec or whatever.
That's right.
Famous quote. Right.
So Sinn Féin boycotted Lloyd George's convention, and it was a complete failure. So having tried to be nice, the British reversed direction again and arrested the leaders of the new independence movement. This was in the spring of 1918. One of them, Michael Collins, escaped arrest. So they put a price on his head, £10,000, dead or alive. Nobody took them up on the offer. In 1919, General French led a peace parade through the streets of Dublin. And the peace parade featured a procession of tanks. another photo in Taylor's book. He's capable of being very sarcastic. So he's got a nice caption for that photo as well. It was a very unsubtle reminder to the Irish of the military might that had crushed the rising and could do so again, obviously. So the British managed to make Sinn Féin triumphant. The Shinners won most of the Irish seats in the 1919 election. And rather than go to London, they formed their own assembly, the Dáil Éireann, so the Irish Parliament. And Collins was a supreme organizer of the IRA. He organized a strategy of resistance, first passive, then obstructive, and finally active.
There's a Michael Collins movie with Liam Neeson that came out when I was, I think, a teenager. Or maybe not. Maybe I just remember because I was that naive. But I remember watching it and I could not make head or tails of it's not 1996. So I wasn't 20 years old. So I couldn't make head or tails of it. I didn't. I mean, I knew the Irish were in the right, were righteous, but I had no idea. I should probably watch it now. It probably make a lot of sense to me now.
I managed to avoid it.
How come?
Oh, I just read a review and realized, okay, so this is going to be a Hollywood treatment of, well,
how does Hollywood treat it? Like, what's the bias? Is Hollywood going to be biased to what? Because I remember it was Michael Collins was portrayed as a hero.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I remember that the Easter Rising was kind of like the prologue. So Michael Collins is a young man and the Easter Rising, they kind of lose at the beginning. And then I don't know what happens. Maybe he comes out of jail. I don't remember. But then there's something about the Irish Free State getting negotiated. Yeah. And then people don't like him for that. And then he gets assassinated or something.
Yes.
But I guess we'll be covering all of that in our interwar.
Yeah. De Valera and Collins and the Civil War and all of that stuff.
Civil War, 1922, yeah?
That's when the Free State was founded.
Okay,
1922. But yeah, first they shot at the British and then they shot at each other. So to repeat the opening of the episode, the Easter Rising was a total failure, and yet it was a complete success. It became apparent to the Irish, certainly, and to the British a little later, that British rule in Ireland was becoming impossible. And the leaders of the Rising, when alive, had very few supporters, even among Irish nationalists. But dead, they were now heroes.
By the way, the Indian Republic, India had an Indian Republican army modeled on the Irish Republican army. Yeah, in the 20s, 30s. There are so many parts of the Indian independence struggle that are violent and Republican and so on that are just completely I've only discovered recently because it's mostly covered up by Gandhi and nonviolence. So,
well, Gandhi might have known what Collins was doing too, because the original resistance was, you know, passive and then obstructive.
Yes.
They didn't start by shooting.
That's right.
So Fitzgibbon says that this became a prototype for the overthrow of the British Empire elsewhere. That might be overstating it, but you know, if you're saying that in India they were well aware of what had gone on in Ireland and decided to copy it.
Absolutely.
But what is certain is that Britain embarrassed itself, because they were claiming to be fighting World War One to defend democracy. I know. Sure. Considering
did they
that
really
Russia
say
is your
that?
Ally.
I don't remember. I thought they were defending neutrality or something. I didn't know they were defending democracy.
Well, okay, they were also trying to rescue small neutral nations like Belgium from the Germans.
From the big bad Germans, yeah.
Right. So the Easter Risings and the executions that followed revealed that this was nonsense. But Taylor says the British had no twinge of conscience. They still paraded unshakable confidence in the righteousness of their cause and the certainty of victory.
Well.
Yeah, you're not surprised, I know, but...
Yeah, it's about it's what do you call it? On brand. It's certainly on brand.
Yeah. So we will come back to Ireland in the 1920s. Should we ever manage to get to the 1920s?
Yeah. Well, we're progressing at a steady clip, Dave. I have every faith that we will get to our interwar and beyond.
Well, it would seem a major disservice to be leaving some of these things out. So even though they're not always directly connected to the war, I can't see skipping them.
Indeed.
So what are we doing next? Oh, we're going to tackle the question of women in the war.
Yeah. I mean, women were huge in this uprising too. They were out and out combatants and,
we're going to do a little myth busting, though.
Great.
Okay.